Good evening. Which microphone is the one for amplification? This one? Okay. And I've been told it's not very strong, so I need to... It's also too short. I don't know if it'll stay up. Okay. I have a loud voice. Can you hear me in the back? Great. All right. Well, thank you all for coming. I want to say I just... I've been really overwhelmed by the welcome I've received in Pittsburgh. And, you know, to be honest, it sometimes feels very... we feel very isolated when we do the work we do. Sometimes we feel, although we're not, we feel like we're the only ones doing it. And in the sense that we're just so disconnected from each other. And I think it's just so energizing to come and see the great work that's going on in Pittsburgh. And there are many people to thank for organizing my visit here. And I know that I've only met a few of them. Noor and Kate and others, and I'm not doing justice to everyone who has participated in bringing me here, but I want to acknowledge that and thank you, and it means a lot to me. And I just came from CMU, and we had a very exciting time with counter demonstrators and everything. It was really a good time. I think they left disappointed. I don't think they got quite what they wanted out of the protest. But they didn't stop us from having a serious discussion. And I see already a few familiar faces who were with us at CMU. And so if I repeat myself, I apologize and bear with me. But I haven't prepared a written lecture, so it's very likely I will also say some new things. I want to talk about where we are in the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, a conflict that has been going on for a century, and where we're going, where I think we're going, and what I think we need to do. And I say that and I need to hear from you what we need to do, because I think we're in a certain sense at an impasse, at a transitional moment where we have to fundamentally reassess our strategies and our approaches. The prevailing or dominant narrative that exists now in the mainstream media, in the government, in the think tanks in Washington, a sort of collective that I refer to as the peace process industry, for shorthand. The narrative that they're putting out now is that there is a window of opportunity for peace. And this window of opportunity was supposedly opened by the death of Yasser Arafat. There was a really unseemly delight at the death of Yasser Arafat. It was a tragic death of a historic figure, someone I personally and many other Palestinians had criticized sometimes very vigorously and very severely. At the same time, we have to recognize that Yasser Arafat died the way many other Palestinians die, as a prisoner of the Israeli occupation. He lived his last few years under house arrest by the Israeli army, unable to move freely. The Israeli government frequently threatened to murder him, and in the end they did, because it's clear that his condition, his illness, was certainly... if not brought about, what contributed to it was the cruel and inhumane conditions in which the Israelis imprisoned him. So his death, we were told, is supposed to be a window of opportunity, and the narrative is that he was the obstacle to peace. And this is a very convenient narrative for the Israeli government and for its supporters, because it's a magical explanation which explains away everything else. It's very simple. Yasser Arafat, although he was a prisoner, was the puppet master who controlled the actions and minds of every Palestinian. So the narrative goes. And now we're told that we have a respectable Palestinian leadership, a leadership liked by George Bush. We're also told that Mahmoud Abbas, I don't remember if it was the New York Times or the LA Times or one of them, that he wears a silk tie. That's part of his appeal. And I don't usually wear a tie when I speak, but I've taken to wearing a silk tie so that I can be taken seriously, because that apparently is what it takes. And the narrative is that the Palestinian people have just had a democratic election in which they selected Abbas, who is a moderate, who wants to end the errant and vicious ways of the Palestinians, and lo, peace is at hand. I want to say a few words about the election and then talk about the situation on the ground, and then try to analyze what it all means. The official narrative of the election is that the Palestinians proved, as if, you know, they needed to prove it, that they can be nice democratic people like the rest of us. They turned out in large numbers to vote, and Mahmoud Abbas won a crushing victory. The reality is a little bit different. The first thing that is important to know is that the vast majority of Palestinians were not invited to vote in this election. The vast majority of Palestinians do not live in the occupied West Bank, Gaza Strip, and East Jerusalem. The population of those areas is about a third of the Palestinian people, and two-thirds of the Palestinian people almost live in exile as refugees in Jordan, in Syria, in Lebanon, in the United States, in South America, all over the world. And what makes their absence from the process particularly suspicious is that if you look at the election that just took place in Iraq, which was backed by the same forces that backed the Palestinian election, the United States, the UN, the EU, and all of these people, they made tremendous efforts to allow Iraqi exiles to vote. What exactly they were voting for is another matter, since the lists of candidates were kept secret. But anyway, the important thing was that they could vote, supposedly. And we saw the US and the UN spending tens of millions of dollars so that Iraqis in Chicago, in Los Angeles, in Washington, D.C., in Sydney, Australia, could vote. And that's a great thing. I'm not against people voting. It just is quite suspicious that these same powers said not a word about Palestinian refugees. And it's clear that the result of the election of Abbas was predetermined. We all knew in advance who would win. And at any sign, an election is supposed to be a contest. You have a contest of ideas and candidates. And the backers of the election were horrified at the prospect that this election could accidentally turn into a genuine contest whose outcome would be determined by the voters. And we saw that the enormous efforts when Marwan Barghouti, one of the leaders of Fatah, who is in Israeli prison, stood for election, put himself forward, and all of the opinion surveys showed that among the Palestinians who could vote, the ones, only the ones in the occupied territories, he could win. And he was more popular than Mahmoud Abbas. There was a massive international effort, which included the US, Israel, the Palestinian Authority, the European Union, the UN, the New York Times editorial page, all pressuring Marwan Barghouti to withdraw, lest the election actually turn into a contest. And the wrong candidate win, which would be very embarrassing for everyone. And the candidates that did run against Abbas, everything possible was done to make sure that there could be no fair contest. Abbas was crowned in advance. It was a coronation. And the moment Arafat died, the U.S. announced $20 million in aid for the Palestinian Authority, and Israel announced the release of $40 million in Palestinian taxes, which it collects, and then is supposed to hand over to the Palestinian Authority, but the Israelis hadn't been doing that, in order to give Abbas a pool of cash, which he could use quickly to consolidate support, buy support and patronage, which is very important in a population that is in such a desperate situation as Palestinians under the occupation. And Israel did its best to ensure that candidates like Mustafa Barghouti, a respected physician and human rights activist and a distant relation of Marwan Barghouti, who did run, he was arrested several times for trying to campaign in the largest Palestinian city, Jerusalem. Several other candidates were forbidden from leaving the Gaza Strip, so they could not actually campaign in the West Bank, which makes a mockery of the notion that there was an election. Meanwhile, Abbas, who didn't feel a great need to actually go and campaign in the West Bank since he wasn't too worried about the result of the election, was on an international tour of Arab and other capitals, being crowned and being endorsed and being blessed as the winner in advance. And I think Palestinians understood that this election was not intended for them to really make a choice determining their future, which is why only 46% of eligible voters in the occupied territories bothered to show up at the polls. This isn't because Palestinians don't like to vote. We just saw last week municipal elections were held in Gaza for the first time for 118 seats in various municipal councils. There was a very high turnout. Hamas won 77 of the 118 seats, and Mahmoud Abbas's Fatah movement won 26 of the seats. A clear indication, at least, of what Palestinians in Gaza vote, how they would vote in an election where they have a chance to express more of a choice. And the results were similar in the municipal elections which were held in parts of the West Bank in December, elections which were held only in areas that were supposedly Fatah strongholds, but in fact the result was that Fatah did much worse, and that's Mahmoud Abbas's movement, did much worse than was expected. And of course, so in the election, 775,146 votes were cast, if we accept the figures from the Central Election Commission, which is about, there are 9 million Palestinians in the world, fewer than 10% of the Palestinian population actually voted in this election. But that is now hailed as democracy. Now, we're told constantly that this is a window of opportunity, and yesterday in his State of the Union address, President Bush said that he's sending Condoleezza Rice, the Secretary of State, to Palestine, Israel, to meet with Abbas and Sharon and advance the peace process. And one of the things he said in the State of the Union is that he would be, that Ms. Rice would be helping the Palestinians to end terror. Well, that's a very good thing, because let me tell you about the terror which the Palestinians need help ending. The statistics which I compiled from the Palestinian Center for Human Rights in Gaza, which does just a tremendous job documenting the violations of human rights across the occupied territories. Their website at pchrgaza.org has just a level of detail and information that is unparalleled. Since the beginning of this year, so that's since January 1st, the Israeli army has killed 56 Palestinians in the occupied territories, which, you know, in the U.S. context would amount to several hundred or several thousand Americans, proportionately. 39 of them were civilians, 20 of them were children, 2 of them were women, 1 elderly woman, and 3 of them were people with disabilities. In many cases, these Palestinian civilians are killed in their homes, killed on the way to school. One little girl was killed in her classroom, and this is a frequent occurrence in the occupied territories. 2 children were killed on Eid al-Adha. 7 children were killed in a single incident by an Israeli tank shell. And it goes on. In addition to this, the demolition of dozens of homes. One example, a house and an entire apartment building were destroyed as part of Israeli retaliatory measures. And, you know, this 35 houses were destroyed in a single place in Rafah. All of this going on unabated. And yet, and you can be sure that if 20 Israeli children had been killed, 3 Israelis with disabilities had been killed by Palestinians since the beginning of the year, that's all we would be hearing about. But when it's Palestinians being killed, it's called a relative calm. Relative because only the Palestinians are being killed. But what we're supposed to believe is that violence has ended. How much power does Mr. Abbas have to serve the interests of his people? And how seriously do the Israelis take this window of opportunity, so-called? Well, the day before the election, the Israeli newspaper Haaretz published a lengthy report headlined Quietly Carrying On Building, which revealed 2 very salient facts. One is that Israel is drawing up construction plans in 120 settlements across the occupied West Bank with the full approval and knowledge of Condoleezza Rice. And according to an Israeli government official quoted in that article, who was explaining this generous U.S. approach to settlement building on occupied Palestinian land, he said, if the U.S. recognizes your claim that the settlement blocks will remain yours forever, why should it make a fuss when you build on your own property? Actually, quite logical in a way. And according to the Israeli group Peace Now, most of the new construction is concentrated in the area between the 1967 border between Israel and the West Bank and the apartheid wall which Israel has built through the West Bank. Now, you may recall that early last year, the Palestinians went to the International Court of Justice in The Hague. The Palestinians are constantly being lectured. Don't use violence, use peaceful means. Okay, they went to the International Court of Justice. They were opposed by virtually every European government and the United States, who told them, don't go to the International Court of Justice. Why? Because they knew that the International Court of Justice would see clearly what the situation was, and it ruled that the wall is illegal and needs to be dismantled, and it said that all of the signatories to the Fourth Geneva Convention, more than 118 countries, have a duty to work for the dismantlement of the wall and to do everything possible to stop Israel building the wall. Of course, that hasn't happened. But Israel's defense of the wall has always been just to defend ourselves. We have no intentions on the land. Well, here is the evidence now that Israel is rushing to colonize the land, build Jewish-only settlements on it as fast as possible. A few days after the election, it was revealed that in July, the Israeli cabinet had voted to revive the 1955 absentee property law. The absentee property law is notorious for Palestinians because when Israel was created and three-quarters of the Palestinian population were displaced forcibly or fled from their homes and not allowed to return by Israel, the Israelis said, oh, well, if you're absent from your property from a certain amount of time, you forfeit it. Well, obviously, if you're not allowed to return to your property, you're not voluntarily absent, but that's just a little detail. So now, with the construction of the wall around occupied Jerusalem, thousands of Palestinians who own property in Jerusalem can't get to their property. So this is a great time for Israel to revive the absentee property law and to say, oh, these Palestinians have mysteriously disappeared. Now, the Israelis seem to have been embarrassed by this, and the Attorney General of Israel has supposedly overturned the decision. Now, I think this is purely tactical, and the Israelis will wait until the spotlight is off this, and then they will go ahead and do what they plan to do anyway. That is historically what has always happened. It's interesting that one of the Israeli ministers who took this decision to confiscate Palestinian property in Jerusalem and who has defended it and said that it's absolutely valid is none other than Natan Sharansky, Mr. Bush's new guru. You may have read that Natan Sharansky, the former Soviet dissident and now an Israeli minister, has written this book on freedom and democracy that has so inspired George Bush. And apparently, to Mr. Sharansky, the freedom includes the freedom to steal people's property because they're the wrong ethnicity. Now, what's going on is a rerun of what happened in the early 1990s. Mr. Arafat, the terrible terrorist leader who just died, wasn't always seen that way by the United States and Israel. In fact, he was presented very much in a similar light to Abbas back in the early 90s. His election was also orchestrated in 1996, and he was supported by Israel, the United States, the Europeans, and the whole, the same gang that is supporting Abbas now. Why? Because they thought that Arafat had signed up to be the local police commander on behalf of the occupation. It's important to remember that throughout the entire 10 years of the peace process, if it can be called that, Israel doubled the number of settlers in the occupied territories. And this, and we're supposed to think this is a benign process, and what we don't see, what the media help to render invisible and what the rhetoric of our leaders make invisible is the incredible violence of the settlement project, because you can't take people's land, you can't take their homes against their will without using enormous violence against them. And so while this violence continued, which quite predictably generated Palestinian counter-violence, and this violence has taken forms that are considered under international law legitimate resistance, and it has taken forms that I personally and many other people would condemn, attacks targeting Israeli civilians and so on. But this violence, it was the predictable outcome of Israel's continued violence against Palestinians. But Arafat was expected to police the Palestinians and to eliminate any resistance to the occupation while the occupation continued to grow and colonize Palestinian land. And exactly the same role has now been assigned to Abbas. And as long as he's willing to do that, he will be praised for his silk tie and his smooth manner of speaking. And when he is no longer willing to do that or incapable of doing that, we will start to hear about corruption, and we will start to hear that he's saying one thing in Arabic and another thing in English, and we'll start to hear all sorts of things that will transform him into the demon that is the obstacle to peace. And you know, I can predict the New York Times editorial, which will say, Mr. Abbas held such hope for the Palestinian people, and he's proved to be such a disappointment that he didn't have the courage to help them break their ways. And, you know, it's a very predictable script, which has been written in advance, and I think will be played out fairly quickly. But Abbas has done some fairly extraordinary things. He has ordered, under U.S. pressure, and he's won a lot of praise for this from the U.S., Palestinian police to defend Israel. This is extraordinary, because Palestinians cannot call on the Palestinian Authority to defend them. Palestinians whose orchards are being destroyed every day, whose land is being taken, who are under attack, who are having their homes bulldozed, we'll never see the Palestinian Authority police standing between them and the Israeli army. That's not their job. That's not what they were given uniforms for. Their job is to protect Israelis against Palestinians. And this is a situation which is untenable. And what it will lead to is, of course, that as Israeli violence continues at the rate it's going on, Palestinian counter-violence will continue, and then we'll be told, because the Israeli violence is invisible, that, oh, the Palestinians, so much hope, this window of opportunity, and there go the Palestinian militants again, trying to destroy the peace process. This is the story that we will be told. Now, the situation in the occupied territories is so far removed from the rhetoric of this window of opportunity of peace. And I think it has been accurately characterized by many people, but I cite in particular South African law professor John Dugard, who is also the special rapporteur for human rights in the Palestinian territories for the United Nations, who wrote in several reports to the UN General Assembly recently, and I quote from one in August, that Israel has created an apartheid regime in the occupied territories worse than the one that existed in South Africa. That's pretty astonishing. And Dugard is in a good position to know, because he was also a member of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa after the end of apartheid. Archbishop Desmond Tutu, the former Archbishop of Cape Town, has written, after visiting Palestine, he wrote, "I've been very deeply distressed in my visit to the Holy Land. It reminded me so much of what happened to us black people in South Africa. I've seen the humiliation of the Palestinians at checkpoints and roadblocks, suffering like us when young white police officers prevented us from moving about." And the Israeli human rights group B'Tselem, in a report issued just a few months ago, described the system of Jewish-only roads in the occupied territories, and the whole infrastructure, which is for Jewish settlers only, as apartheid. And B'Tselem said that it's a situation unique in the world. There is no situation comparable to it at the present time. And yet we're told that there's a roadmap to peace. Where does this roadmap lead? We should be clear that what is on offer to the Palestinians, the maximum that is on offer, is something very similar to what the apartheid regime in South Africa tried to impose, a system of so-called homelands for the native population, which were nominally independent. And the advantage of this for the rulers is that it removes political responsibility for them. The rulers can say, oh, they don't have to vote in South Africa because they're in independent states. But at the same time, these so-called independent states are completely powerless. Some people think that Israel's so-called disengagement plan from Gaza is the first step in a peace process and signals the beginning of the end to the occupation. And so many people, even in the Israeli peace movement, support it. They say, well, it's a start. Well, let's start with Gaza and then that will build momentum. But of course, you have to ignore a lot of evidence in order to be able to reach that conclusion. Because what Israel is trying to do with respect to Gaza is what it tried to do with Sinai, the occupied Sinai Peninsula, with respect to Egypt 25 years ago. Israel thought that by giving back Sinai to Egypt, it would be allowed to keep the West Bank and Gaza. Now it's trying the same trick with Gaza. It thinks that by going through this charade in Gaza, that it will be allowed to keep the West Bank. And the Israelis say it clearly. I mean, we don't have to guess at their motives. In October, Ariel Sharon's most senior advisor, Dov Weisglass, told Haaretz, in Hebrew, because in English, the Israelis say they're in favor of the roadmap for peace. In Hebrew, they say something else. He was asked what the significance of the Gaza disengagement plan is, and he said, the significance of the disengagement plan is the freezing of the peace process. And when you freeze that process, you prevent the establishment of a Palestinian state, and you prevent a discussion on the refugees, the borders, and Jerusalem. Effectively, this whole package called the Palestinian state, with all that it entails, has been removed indefinitely from our agenda. And all this with authority and permission, all with a presidential blessing and the ratification of both houses of Congress. The disengagement is actually formaldehyde. It supplies the amount of formaldehyde that is necessary so there will not be a political process with the Palestinians. Now, the Israelis are willing to take whatever outcome they determined through force, through building this system of walls. And at CMU we were able to project, I don't think we can do that here from the internet, and to show some of the satellite images of what the wall looks like and how it really imprisons Palestinians in their towns and villages and creates giant open-air prisons which are just destroying Palestinian life. A friend of mine recently returned from Palestine, and she was talking about the wall as it goes through the Palestinian village of Beit Hanina near Jerusalem. And she commented, she said, you know, even if you accept the logic of the Israelis for building this wall, there's still something gratuitously sadistic about it. She talked about a part of Beit Hanina, which is a little village. The whole village is five streets, where the wall runs, cuts off two blocks of the village from the other three. And it's absolutely impenetrable. It's a 6 or 7 hour trip around the wall. As she said, even if the Israelis want to build this wall, couldn't they have allowed all of Beit Hanina to stay in one piece? There's something gratuitously sadistic about this. And I don't think that we are able really to understand what it means in our own experience, what it would mean. I remember in 1986, when I was in high school and I went on a school trip to East Berlin, to Berlin, and saw the wall, and saw the wall as it went down the middle of streets, and how it people who would look out of their window and would have seen their neighbors across the road now saw a concrete wall. I don't think we can relate to that. And that's what's going on, affecting hundreds of towns and villages, tens of thousands of Palestinian families, that your next door neighbor's house becomes a 7 or 8 hour trip. Is, I think, very hard to imagine. To continue, if I may, with the analogy with South Africa, which is not a perfect one, but of course it is in a sense a guide for us that can provide us with some reference. President Bush said last year that there would be a Palestinian state by 2005. And last week he updated us on progress, and he said that the Palestinian state will be created ahead of schedule, those are his words, ahead of schedule by 2009. President Bush seems to have invented a time machine. But it's increasingly clear that what is on offer as a Palestinian state, if that, is nothing more than this kind of Bantustan. And in October, we had an analysis which I think is significant and I'd like to share with you from F.W. de Klerk, the last president of the apartheid regime in South Africa, in an interview with the Dutch newspaper Haagse Courant, 16th October 2004. And I read you this from the article, which is translated from Dutch. He's talking first about South Africa, and he says, for de Klerk, recent history was about the practical question of how to preserve the Afrikaners next to the black peoples, and the answer came in the form of apartheid. Now, quoting de Klerk, the idea was originally sound. As a young parliamentarian, I was enthusiastic about forming independent homelands for every group, including the Afrikaners, which would subsequently cooperate in a federation. There was a serious study of 4,000 pages about this in 1954. Mr. de Klerk continues, the roadmap between Israel and Palestine is based on exactly the same principles. And so there you have it. And I think what we see on the ground bears that out. What I think we're seeing now, if we take the long view, is the intended outcome of 4 decades of Israeli policy in the occupied territories. From the very beginning, from 1968, when the Israeli government started putting the first settlers into the West Bank. It was stated clearly that the goal was to create facts on the ground which would prevent an Israeli withdrawal, to make it so, you know, it doesn't matter what the rest of the world says, facts on the ground is what speaks. And this was designed to preempt the possibility of a two-state solution. The creation of an independent Palestinian state next to Israel. Now, again, without going too much into the history, although we can get to it in the discussion soon, the West Bank and Gaza Strip represent what? They represent 22% of historic Palestine. They represent a fifth of the country in which Palestinians were an overwhelming majority until Israel was created. And when Israel was created, 3/4 of the Palestinian population were displaced, and Israel was created on 78% of the land. And most Palestinians do not come from the West Bank and Gaza Strip. They come from towns and villages and cities that were inside Israel. And so when the Palestinians offered this historic compromise to the Israelis and said, we will accept a state in the West Bank and Gaza, you would have thought the Israelis, if they were wise, would recognize the far-reaching compromise that the Palestinians offered them and would have accepted it. But the Israeli response has always been a consistent no. And a no which is not a no in words, but a no with bulldozers. And Israel has continued to colonize and divide and partition and annex the West Bank. And with the stated goal of making a Palestinian state and an Israeli withdrawal impossible. And I think we have reached the point. It's debatable whether we reached it a year ago, whether we're reaching it now, or whether we'll reach it in 3 years or 5 years. But I think we are reaching that tipping point, let's say, where the Israelis have succeeded in creating a situation that just can't be rolled up like a carpet. That there are 400,000 Israeli settlers now in the West Bank, living among 3.5-4 million Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza. And there are towns and cities of Israeli settlers which have been there for a generation, and almost two generations of Israeli children born in the settlements. These are facts. Legally, they have no right to be there, but they're facts that they were born there and they didn't ask to be born there. And as sort of counterintuitive as it is to me, because my parents were forced from their homes, and even though the settlers are there illegally and have stolen the homes of other people, I can still hear what they're saying when they say that they don't want to leave, as a human being, not as a matter of law. And the children didn't ask to be born in the settlements. That doesn't mean I concede the legal fact that the settlements are illegal, and that the children of the settlers do not inherit any rights because the presence is illegal, in the same way that Palestinian refugees' children don't lose their rights because the initial condition of their displacement was illegal. But I'm talking about on a human level, that when we say end the occupation now, which is the main demand of the peace movement, what does it really mean? Do we mean just remove the soldiers and the checkpoints? Do we mean remove 400,000 settlers? Or do we mean, most of the Israeli peace movement means, just leave the bits that we don't want and keep most of the settlements? Because that's what the consensus in among most of the Israeli peace movement is. Even the authors of the so-called Geneva Initiative, if you listen to what some of the leaders of that movement say, is I want to read you one thing. Yossi Beilin, I'm sorry, General Amram Mitzna, who was the former leader of the Labour Party and one of the authors of the Geneva Initiative, and for those of you who are unfamiliar with it, this is a sort of a mock peace agreement which is negotiated by former Israeli officials from the mainstream left, or the peace movement, and some former Palestinian Authority officials, and they got this big fanfare and literally smoke and mirrors. They had this big launch in Geneva with dry ice and laser lights and things. And it's, we were told that it shows that there are Palestinians to talk to, that an agreement is possible. All you need is good leaders and nice people who are willing to do it. But then when you actually listen to what the Israeli authors of the Geneva Accord told the Israeli people, again in Hebrew, although this, to be fair, did appear in English in Haaretz too, but Amram Mitzna. For the first time in history, the Palestinians explicitly and officially recognized the state of Israel as the state of the Jewish people forever. They gave up the right of return to the state of Israel, and a solid, stable Jewish majority was guaranteed. The Western Wall, the Jewish quarter of Jerusalem, and David's Tower will all remain in our hands. The suffocating ring was lifted from over Jerusalem, and the entire ring of settlements around it. None of the settlers in those areas will have to leave their homes. And this from people who say they're in favor of ending the occupation. What that means is that end the occupation means precisely what you want it to mean and nothing more. And it doesn't mean, in this conception, what it means in international law, which is a full return to the line of June 4th, 1967. And then we're told that, oh, the outline of a peace deal is known, that it will be based on the 1967 border. What does that mean? It means that where it's in Israel's interest to respect the 1967 border, we respect it. When Israel, it's not in Israel's interest, we violate it. And when you say, well, let's look at the details, you're told either, oh, well, details will be worked out. You know, we'll work them out. There'll be a one-for-one land swap. All the proposals of what land swap that have been out there are like saying we will trade Manhattan for an equally sized piece of North Dakota. It's the same.